Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacy Toth of PaleoParents.com and author of two paleo cookbooks. The first, Eat Like Dinosaur, kid-friendly gluten-free recipe and guidebook, and Beyond Bacon, recipes that respect the whole hog.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne, also known as the Paleo Mom. I have a background in medical research, and I love to write approachable explanations of the whys behind the paleo diet. I'm also the author of two upcoming books, The Paleo Approach, which is a complete guide to managing autoimmune disease using diet and lifestyle, and the companion guide, The Paleo Approach Cookbook.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. So, we've had a little bit of electronic magic happen, and we are now joined by the resource that we think might be able to help us get our razzle-dazzle together. It is none other than the billion-time New York Times bestseller, Diane Sanfilippo of Balance Bites. Welcome to the show, and congratulations on your second New York Times bestselling book.
Diamond List.
Crazy.
21-Day Sugar Detox. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We've had you on the show before, and we've broken bacon together before, so I feel like I can...
Sorry. I really thought that was funny.
I mean, what else are you going to do? So, we thought that it would be a really good opportunity to have you on the show, talk a little bit about both of your recent books that have come out. I know I've seen on your communication and social media that people are a little bit confused. So maybe you can kind of give an explanation of book number 2 and 3 that both recently came out, and kind of give people a little bit of a detox show in general, because it is the holiday season. I think, was it last year that we had you on to talk about recovery after that? It might have been like the same time last year.
I think it was closer to Thanksgiving last year.
Yeah, maybe. So we'll put a link in the show notes for when Diana was on last time to talk about recovery. We're going to touch a little bit on that, but more from like a detox perspective, because obviously your second and third books are on sugar detox. And it is a really good time for people to start thinking about kind of New Year's resolutions and what they want to do with that, whether that's nothing at all because you, you know, choose to be, you know, living your life as you want 24/7, which is great, or whether it's kind of thinking about how you may or may not have, you know, loosened up the boundaries over, you know, the last couple of weeks or months, and how you might want to use the New Year's as a way to kind of refocus yourself, which is what I often do with a 21-day sugar detox after New Year's, because that's the way I try to eat and live all the time, with the exception of a reasonable amount of fresh fruit. So when I do a 21-day sugar detox, it refocuses me on, you know, what are my nutrient-dense food choices and how can I get myself off of the cycle that I'm easily put on, which is the regular consumption of sweet things. And I think that means, you know, something different for everyone. But whether it's sweets or whether it's, you know, we did like a no-spend month last year, or whatever your detox may be, hopefully this show can kind of be applicable to that across the board. So welcome, Diane.
Thanks. I think that's a good point, too, about like whatever kind of detox you want to have, because you know, a lot of times people talk about a social media detox, or, you know, a television detox, or, you know, spending detox, as you talked about. And the definition of detox that I have in the 21-Day Sugar Detox book is the process, whether real or perceived, of removing toxins from the body. And that's in relation to this program. But it's really a matter of getting either something out of your body or out of your system, or getting a habit sort of out of your life for a while, just creating new habits and resetting what you're doing. And, you know, it's not actually even gimmicky to call it a sugar detox, because what we do by taking excess sugar, refined foods, and alcohol out of the diet is actually alleviate some of the stress put on our liver by those things. So it isn't entirely, you know, oh, it's just I'm calling it a detox, but I'm just using that word. Like, there is some you know, realistic help that your liver gets when you get rid of that stuff. So that, in which your liver is what detoxifies your body naturally 24/7, 365. So that's really where kind of the support comes in. So do you want me to talk about the books or the program, or how do you want me to introduce folks to it?
Add whatever you think is the best easiest way for people to understand kind of how that whole thing works together.
Okay, so the 21-Day Sugar Detox is a program that I originally created over 3.5 years ago. So for people who know me and follow my work and maybe have my first book, Practical Paleo, I actually didn't even follow or teach about paleo when I created the 21-Day Sugar Detox. So I already knew about avoiding things like gluten, dairy, soy, refined foods, all of that. But paleo wasn't quite something that I had tuned into. But this whole idea of getting excess carbohydrate, specifically refined carbs and what I refer to as bad carbs, say that with like air finger quotes, because when I call something a bad carb, it's really just that it's nutrient poor, it's refined or man-made. So, you know, I don't think that fruit is a bad carb, but for the purposes of a 21-day sugar detox, most fruit is not included. So all that being said, I created this program 3.5 years ago. Many people listening probably know, I know you, Stacey and Sarah both know that it was an ebook program for a long time. And, you know, it just got to the point where folks were asking me, can I get this in print? And at some point, and that point would be when I was almost finished writing Practical Paleo, and the publisher said, what do you think about printing the 21-Day Sugar Detox? And I'm pretty sure my exact response was something to the effect of, I'm glad we're not in the same room because I might punch you or something. Because that was probably in like May, I think, of that year, or early June, and the book went to print late June of that year. It was insane. So anyway, long story short, it just became this thing where, you know, we wanted to get this into a book. And, you know, so what the printed book is not is a reproduction of the ebook. I actually, and I did this with Practical Paleo too, because a lot of people don't know that I had this ebook called Practical Paleo Nutrition Guidebook. And I thought when I wrote it that I had something to sort of start from in creating a print book. And so with the 21-Day Sugar Detox, people might think that I started from the ebook and just kind of translated it. And I basically scrapped almost everything that was in the ebook and started over. And so the only thing that remains pretty much the same is the core of the intention of the program. Most of those like yes, no foods, there's a few things that have been added to the yes list, and just additional, you know, foods that people had been asking about that maybe weren't on the list anywhere before. So the core of the program remains the same. But in terms of what I'm providing, in terms of support and additional information to just help you along the way, what made it into the book is everything that myself and my team sort of collected up over the last 3 years of running the program with regards to, you know, what will help people the most to follow this program. And it's not primarily, you know, 300 pages of why sugar is bad for you, because I think most people sort of come into a 21-day sugar detox or any sort of nutritional reset just feeling like they know what they don't want to eat, because they can tell that they don't feel great when they eat it. And yeah, a little bit of the science behind why we shouldn't eat it, or, you know, what it's doing in our bodies, that really does ground us. Like, yes, this is the right thing for me to do. But most of what people really need is the handholding. And I don't say that in a bad way. I mean, you want to know what to expect day by day. You know, you're coming into this thing. Maybe you have a friend you're doing it with or a coworker, but you want to know, what's this going to feel like? And, you know, day three, when things don't feel like sunshine and rainbows and unicorns, to read in the book that that's normal, I think really, really helps people push through and stick with the program. You know, along those same lines, I have a preparation checklist, what you should do 7 days, 5 days, 3 days, and 1 day before. I think it's really critical that when people take on a nutritional reset program that they get very, very clued in to how to prepare, because that's the key to success. And anybody who's done the 21-Day Sugar Detox will tell you, by day three or four, if you haven't prepared properly, you set yourself up to fail, really, because you are left potentially without something to eat or you don't know what to do. And really getting through that sort of preparation checklist, reading what to expect, and some of the other guides in the book. So, for example, I mean, you guys know I can talk for like the entire hour without you ever asking another question, but I'm just going to go through a couple more things about the book. Because I feel so strongly that I want people to know what they're going to get with this book. And I think most of my fans know that the way I create these things is like such a labor of love, because it's not self-fulfilling. I don't make these books for myself. I write this stuff down and make these resources and these guides because I feel like that's what's going to help the people who are on the program the most. So there's information about supplements, tons and tons of frequently asked questions. And I'm actually flipping some pages right now, so you might hear me flipping through. Tons and tons of frequently asked questions in different categories too. So about like mindset, about the food, all of that stuff. I have a daily success log. So if you just want to photocopy it, or you can print it off the website and just kind of jot down how things are going, which is great because on day 15, when you're not sure why you're doing this, which, you know, maybe you're feeling great or maybe it's not a great day, you can look back at day one and be like, oh yeah, that's right. You know, this is how I was feeling then. And I'm actually feeling so much better now, or my sleep is better, or my training has been better. Information on how to replace foods that you might commonly be eating now, and, you know, what to use instead. So just for example, stuff that we know in the paleo community, like instead of soy sauce or even wheat-free tamari, we might use coconut aminos. But I wrote this book really for, you know, anyone out there, not just folks who eat paleo. So I think that's something that a lot of times people don't know about. And tips for dining out and things like that. So the book is really similar in format to Practical Paleo in that the first chunk of pages is all kind of the background program information. And then it goes right into meal plans, one for each level, along with modifications. And then recipes, over 90 recipes in the first book. And then just to tell you what's different about the second book is that none of that program information, the what to expect, the frequently asked questions, all of that like nitty gritty about how to tackle the program, that stuff's not in the cookbook. The cookbook was literally one of those moments where I was driving on my long drive from New Jersey to Pittsburgh to visit my friends and my boyfriend. And I thought, you know, people are going to want more recipes. Like literally I had this thought, people are going to want more recipes. There's over 90 in the book. That's a lot of recipes. But as you guys know, and Stacey, as you mentioned, some people come back to the program, not because it wasn't successful, but you know, you want to get yourself on the program. You have different reasons for jumping in. Maybe you're just supporting a friend who's doing it. So it's your second or third or even fourth time completing the program. And maybe after a while, you know, those 90 recipes, you just want more ideas. And I think that's one of the things about the sugar detox is that you, because you're more limited in food choices, you have to just get a little bit more creative. And so I just felt like more recipes would really help people, but I didn't want to make the first book bigger. That was like a huge, huge goal of mine, was to keep that book a small portable size. It's maybe a little over a pound, and it's like diminutive next to Practical Paleo, just for, you know, an idea of the scale.
Yeah, compared to the nearly 5 pounds that Practical Paleo probably is. Yeah.
It's like 4 pounds, I think. So it's really small and everyone says it's so cute. You know, the 21-day sugar detox, and you can literally throw it in your purse or your backpack or your briefcase and take it to the store and just kind of use it. And that's what I want people to do. You know, because while you're on the program, you know, you want to flip to those pages and just kind of check things out. So the cookbook is really exactly that. It's just a cookbook. And I don't say that to mean that if something is only a cookbook, it's not as good as something else. It's just, it doesn't include that other information. So it has meal plans that correspond to the recipes in the book. So that's one thing that it does have. And I did include a couple of additional guides in the cookbook that are unique to the cookbook. So I just put up a blog post explaining what the differences were and what you were getting in one versus the other. But I have a quick fix meal math guide in the cookbook. So it's kind of like if you wanted to throw together protein, fat, veggies, and flavor, you know, just a super quick guide to that. And then one other guide, and then I'll be done talking. A guide to common food allergens, because this is actually something that in both Practical Paleo and the 21-Day Sugar Detox books, I have as most of us do in our books, we have these little call outs, right? If there's nuts, eggs, nightshades, and then I also include if there are FODMAPs and seafood. But I think what a lot of people don't know is what to do if they're not eating eggs and eggs are in a recipe, or they're not eating nuts, nightshades, etc. And so, of course, we know you can't replace 10 eggs with a flax egg. That just won't work. But maybe up to one or two if somebody's doing that. If they're not avoiding eggs for autoimmune reasons, it's just that they're allergic to eggs. You know, I have notes on that. So I actually really love that guide, and that's exclusive to the cookbook. And there's only maybe, I haven't counted, but probably 10 or fewer recipes that are in the cookbook that are repeated from the first book. And so that doesn't mean that those are counted in towards the over 100 new recipes. It's just that I've got things like broth and ketchup and mayonnaise recipes that, you know, if you're making a recipe from the cookbook, you don't want to have to go find the other books. So we put kind of those staples repeated. But beyond that, there's 100 new recipes for the sugar detox in the cookbook. And I'm officially insane, and no more books for at least a little while.
Be careful what you say, because it will come back to bite you later.
I know. So that's everything for now. What else can I tell you guys?
I have a question about the cookbook.
Yes.
On the front cover, the picture underneath 21-day meal plans, simple to follow whole food plans. What photo is that? It's like spices. It's under.
Oh, yeah, spices in a bowl.
What's the brown spice? Because it looks really yummy. Like the one that's 3/4 of it?
It's probably cumin.
Okay.
I don't know.
I've been literally obsessing about what photo is.
That was probably so cumin. Sad. It's probably cumin, coriander, and chili powder. That's my guess.
Trifecta. I can see that. The trifecta. But yeah, I've been like, okay, like I think that's spices, and I've been trying to find, like, if I can find that photo in with one of the recipes or somewhere else.
I don't know if it's in there. I actually think it might be from the prep for the smoky tortilla soup, which is in the first book. Sneaky.
Oh, look at that.
Is it?
Now I'm looking in the first book.
I'm flipping through too. Yeah, I think that's what it's from. I don't know if I put that prep picture in the book or not, but you're making me work to remember what I did. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's on page 158 in the first book also.
For everyone who's like also flipping through their books while they listen to the podcast.
Yeah, it's on page 158, but it's on the cover of the cookbook. So it's, I mean, it was just kind of a,
I'm 100% sure you cannot have that, Sarah.
Well, I can't have the chili or the, yeah. I can have the other two spices.
This is all for selfish purposes. Sarah's like, I want to eat this.
I just want to know what this is because I want to eat it.
Can you eat tomatoes or no?
No, I can't. I don't so into the same room as tomatoes.
You can make one of the subs that I've been giving people. I gave people a sub for the bolognese recipe that I have of using canned pumpkin instead of something like canned tomato or tomato paste. So you could make, if you can do the cumin and the coriander, which
I can. I can do cumin and coriander, but I just can't. So I am great with seed-based spices. Yeah. I just can't do nightshade spices.
So if you can do the cumin and the coriander with pumpkin, you can get something as close as possible to sort of that smoky, Mexican-y kind of flavor in the tortilla soup. You know, it's not going to be exactly the same without tomato and chili pepper, but if you get that cumin and coriander in there, you might need to just bump up some of the spices.
Yeah, cumin and coriander and pumpkin are pretty magical together. So I'm kind of thinking there's no way that could be bad.
No, I don't think so. So I think that would be really good. And then maybe just like more onion and garlic and stuff like that.
So I don't have a sticky note. So I'm going to use the gingerbread man sticker that my kids put together for me to mark this page. To make later in the week. Awesome. Thank you for like, that was really the selfish reason for having you on the show, is I was just dying to know what that photo was.
That's hilarious. I'm sure you could have texted me or something.
I know, I could have. I've literally, I've been, I have, this is, I've been like obsessing over it. That's, I shouldn't admit to stuff like that. Yeah, I've been like, okay, that looks really yummy and I want to know what it is.
That's
your
really
photography,
funny.
By the way, I have been meaning to text you and tell you that your photography in these books is beautiful.
Thank you so much. So the first book I did entirely on my own. The second book, if people get to the last page, and what's so funny is that like, I'm really weird when I do these projects. I'm like, this book is only going to be 240 pages, so we're going to have to fit it in 240 pages. Like, I will not push page counts when I'm like, I want the book to be this size. I just get really weird about it. And people who aren't like working on books are like, what are you talking about? But basically, it's either I add 16 pages or I make it all fit, which you guys are aware of.
Yeah.
And so I was like, we're making this fit, I'm not adding 16 more pages. I just don't want the book to be bigger and heavier. I already have a big, heavy book. I don't need another one right now, at least. So anyway, on the last page of the cookbook on page 240, I have a whole thank you, which because I had already thanked many people in the first book, and this one was so quickly thereafter, Tanya Field is someone who I brought onto my team for several months to work on developing recipes with me for the book. And she also shot photos. So we actually shot 50-50 on the recipes and photos in the cookbook. And I was really, you know, it was the kind of thing where I really wanted to get the book done in a timely fashion. I really didn't want it to take another year to get the cookbook out. But when I sat down and thought about, you know, should I get some help or not? The thing that really motivated me to get help with it was just the level of creativity that comes into play when it's more than just me. Like just me sitting in the room trying to think of creative ways to make recipes for the sugar detox. You know, you hit a wall and you get kind of limited. And not to mention the fact that, you know, I have different tastes than other people might have. And I'm not a great baker, you know, as evidenced by the video wherein I burn, when did I make, biscotti from Stacey's book.
I love the moment of redemption, though. Like, there was a moment where you realized what you had done, because I was horrified that we had messed up and that you had filmed it.
I was completely confident that the recipe had no fault. I was like, this is a user error. I knew it in my heart. And as soon as I moved my cookbook stand and was like, oh, see, this inch of cookbook stand was covering the fact that I overbaked this. But anyway, like, I'm not a good baker, and I don't really like to bake. I don't like to test baked goods recipes over and over. It's just mind numbing to me. And so, and I've like totally give credit to the people who love to do it. And so Tanya actually really likes to do that stuff. So we have some amazing, you know, not sweet treats in this book, and just a whole bunch of other recipes that I probably wouldn't have thought of, you know? And so she and I worked on that. So I can't take complete credit for all of the photos in the cookbook because they were 50-50. See if you can tell whose are whose by the props.
I was going to say, yeah, it's actually, you guys matched your styles.
Pretty seamless, really. Right? Yeah. I mean, obviously, as the control freak that I am, I basically, you know, I really helped to teach her as much as I could because she had a talent coming into it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have really, you know, brought her on the team, because I think, you know, I like to spot what people are good at and seem to be passionate about and kind of push them to do it more. So, you know, along the way, you know, she had some photos that I was like, wow, that's just amazing. I'm totally impressed. And some where I would just kind of give her a few points of feedback and then boom, you know. So that was a fun process for sure. And it's, I mean, I'm sure as you guys know too, you know, it's not easy to open up what you're doing to anyone else. And I'm really glad that I did that. I think it's, at the end of the day, it's going to benefit the user, you know, the person who gets the book and has that much more that's interesting and different and creative than what I would have come up with on my own.
Yeah. I mean, I do my books with both Matt and Amy at this point. I mean, we did the first one's just Matt and I, but that was a lot of input from the kids too, because it was such a, you know, like, He Liked Dinosaur is a kid's book. But Beyond Bacon and now the third book are really significantly, there's no way. Like, I need other people to bounce ideas off of, and I end up feeling like Amy is part of the family just because it is such, like, an intimate and involved thing where you're kind of sharing creatively, which is interesting. That
yeah.
You were able to kind of do that with someone that, you know, wasn't your best friend or your husband.
Yeah, I mean, and like Scott can eat the food. My parents ate the food and gave feedback, but you know, it's also that somebody who's like in the community and understands what people on the detox need. And that was actually, you know, Tanya found me and my work from the 21 Day Sugar Detox originally. So it was actually kind of perfect because she's gone through the program a couple of times. So she really knew what it's like, you know, and what people are going to want and what'll help them the most.
That's very cool.
And she's going to like cry if she listens to this podcast now.
So then we shall say, hi, Tanya.
Hi, Tanya.
Oh, I should give her a quick shout out too. She and her friend Claire have their own Facebook page. It's called Flame to Fork. So go check them out.
I think they're going to guest post for us in 2014, Claire and
they're awesome.
Yeah. I love to follow them on Instagram. Okay. So I think we've hit the book and the program definitely hard enough for people who are still with us here. I think.
Sorry.
Unless, Sarah, you have other things that you want to touch on, perhaps we can move on to another Science with Sarah segment, which we brought back last week after taking a couple months off. Because I know I saw your notes.
They weren't entirely off. There was some science that snuck in over those couple of months.
Yeah, we just didn't have a dedicated segment. So it's nice to have a dedicated segment back. And then we're kind of ambitious in the number of questions we pulled as well, considering that we're already half an hour in. So
we'll get to some questions. Why don't we jump into science then?
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
All right, so today's Science with Sarah is going to be a Science with Sarah and Diane because it would be ridiculously foolish of us to not take advantage completely of Diane's like complete expertise in the area of sugar and sugar cravings. And so what I thought would be great is if we could answer the question, why does eating sugar make you want more sugar? Because I think that is the crux of a sugar detox, but it's also, I think, really, you know, the crux of many New Year's resolutions, however you choose to tackle that, whether it's through a sugar detox or your own, you know, other resolutions. I think a lot of it comes from wanting to get back a sense of control over what we're eating after overindulging over the holidays. So I thought this was fantastic for a podcast that was going to air right before New Year's. So Diane, because you are the expert, do you want to take a first stab?
Sure. What's so funny too is that when I was working on this section of my book that's called The Science of Sugar Simplified, which, you know, I think most people know that the way that I try and explain the science of things is to simplify it as much as possible. And it's not to necessarily like dumb it down or, you know, not give people enough information. It's really to just give you the, you know, what do I need to know to make this make sense to me? And then let me just move on. You know, I mean, I feel like that's kind of how I am. I just want to give people the basics and enough of that foundation to say, okay, like I get that. That makes sense. And when I was working on this section, there was a point when Arish, our collective of this entire group publisher, said to me, like, well, why do we like sugar? And it wasn't just, I'm going to get into the whole, like, why do we crave it? But he was like, why do we even like it? Why do we even eat it? Like, what is it that makes us want to eat sugar? You know, and if you think from an evolutionary perspective, you're walking around and there's something sweet, which we know most fruit probably hundreds of years ago, even longer ago, probably wasn't as sweet as it is today. But even honey, it's like, why would we go after this honey that seems to be protected by a very dangerous force field of bees? Like, why would we go after it? And so, you know, I did have to kind of do a little more digging and a little more research and kind of get down to that, the root of why do we even like sugar? And then why do we crave it? Right? Because it's like, what is it about that sweet taste that makes us happy and makes us like it? And so what it really is that we get a dopamine release when we eat something sweet. And I presume, I didn't get into a lot of research on this, but I presume we get that from a lot of those, the food reward types of sensations where we might combine fatty and salty, or we combine fatty and sweet, where we're doing that because those things don't come together in nature. Sweet comes pretty much just sweet. You know, it's carbohydrate, and you don't typically find carbohydrate with fat in nature, right? If you think about it, where you're getting that density of carbohydrate, it's coming from fruit or sweet potato or tubers, those kinds of things. So they're not also going to have the fat. So anyway, back to sort of why do we crave it? Well, if we get that dopamine hit, that feels good. And I think folks know that anything that has an addictive property to it, it's because it's giving us a release of dopamine. We get a release of dopamine even from like caffeine, from the coffee that we're drinking. And, you know, that in and of itself might make us just want more, just even from a surface perspective, not sort of the deeper physiological, what's happening on other levels. Just that made me feel happy because that hormone released, or that neurotransmitter. So that's just kind of the first level. But I think what happens at a deeper level is that when we're eating sugar, and again, this is primarily in the form of bad carbs. So even though sugar detox doesn't, it doesn't eliminate all carbohydrate, it's really just getting rid of bad carbs. But when we eat refined carbs that have caloric and carbohydrate value without the non-caloric components, which are the vitamin and minerals, the nutrients that we should be getting from our carbohydrate foods, we start to deplete our nutrient stores because we use up nutrients to metabolize this carbohydrate. What we need to generate energy and ATP are these nutrients. And what happens if we just continually ask our body to metabolize more and more carbohydrate without actually providing more of the substrate for what it needs to do that? And so your body's going to want more. And it doesn't really care at that moment which more, right? It's asking for carbohydrate because naturally carbohydrate would come with these other components. But what's around us today are Twinkies and Ho-Hos and donuts and, you know, everything else. And it's not just the nutrient-rich forms of carbohydrate, right? So we're just ending up in this cycle where we're craving it because we get that good feeling, but we're depleting our nutrient stores at the same time. And so we're just left in that cycle. And I think most people can kind of feel what that feels like. You ate that food, but you didn't actually feel satisfied from it for more than perhaps a few moments or an hour, right? I mean, that's kind of that vicious cycle also with blood sugar that happens. You know, it's just kind of goes up and down. So Sarah, I mean, please add to
so I have two anecdotal things that I'll throw in that kind of mirror what you say before Sarah can like
totally geek out.
But, you know, one of the things that I noticed kind of after going paleo, and I think now I don't really do this anymore, but one of the things that I realized kind of the first, you know, year was that I had previously always had room for dessert. Like, it didn't matter how much I ate or how much food I had consumed. Like, there was always room for sweets. Like, I could sit at a table and say, I'm stuffed, I couldn't eat another thing. And then the guy would come by with a dessert tray and I'd be like, yes, I'll take one of everything. And I could literally consume all of it. And there's definitely like a difference in kind of not just food reward, but I think the hormone balance and the blood sugar regulation and learning how to kind of, you know, listen to your body has affected my ability to say, okay, I'm not actually hungry. I don't need this. If I want this, like make a better choice, eat in moderation or whatever it is that I'm choosing to indulge in, because that's a choice that I'm making rather than just kind of like mindlessly bathing myself in sugar, which is what I was doing before. And another thing,
although that sounds like fun,
right? That's what sugar scrub is, right?
Exactly.
So, I have noticed lately that since, you know, I talk about it on the podcast, and Dan, I think, you know, like 6 months ago, I started, you know, kind of seriously getting into trying to be stronger and focusing a lot more on, you know, eating for performance, eating for building muscle rather than kind of thinking about things from weight loss, which I had always done before. And then for a while it was improving my health and getting over adrenal fatigue and getting over an autoimmune flare and all that kind of stuff. And so once I had finally healed myself of those things and reached a plateau I was comfortable with weight loss. And then I said, okay, what's really important to me? I want to get strong. And one of the things that I told myself was like, I have to quit eating treats, even if it's a paleo treat, you know, like no more regular alcohol, no more regular treats, no, you know, no more of the stuff. And one of the things that I found myself enjoying was coconut date rolls. Like I get them at the health food store and it's just nothing but dates and coconut and they're pureed together and they're made in a tube. You guys know what I'm talking about? Like it's...
Yes, I'm aware.
Yeah, I've seen them with figs, not dates, but I'm assuming it's the same.
Yeah, and it's... The same thing. Yeah. And it's like...
Nature's candy.
Yes, but it is what I need. Like if I'm feeling desperate at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, like I have absolutely no guilt about having coconut date roll or whatever, as opposed to different choices that I might've made before. So, and it's a nutrient rich source. It's, you know, got my vitamins and minerals and fiber and all kinds of things. It, obviously you wouldn't eat that on a sugar detox, but for like regular living, that sufficed for me as a, you know, I need something in my mouth that tastes sweet. But what's interesting about it is that I can only eat two or three of the date rolls, which are about the size of my thumb at biggest. And I literally like tap out. Like whereas before I could eat like a whole tray of desserts or whatever, like my body naturally, like Diane, you were saying, we create this artificial flavor with salt, sweet, fatty, whatever. When we're using the only ingredients in those date rolls as coconut and dates, my body naturally, I think, you know, has a sufficient amount of the nutrients that it needs or wants from like the fat and the coconut and the sweet, and then says, okay, like two or three, that's all you need. And I put it away and I don't have any more sweets or any interest in sweets after that. Whereas, you know, if that was a dark chocolate of some kind, or that was like,
right,
you know, some sort of like man-made food product. And I still have that where if I eat something other than that, I don't have that natural cutoff. Like I need to tell myself, okay, I'm going to have, you know, four squares of this dark chocolate bar. And, you know, I put it away before I'm even done so that I'm not tempted to like convince myself that it's okay to have more, you know, all the things that us food people have problems with.
There was this is like an aside, but was something that I hit on while
an
I was
aside
researching.
To an aside,
an aside to an aside, but sciency. There was this clinical trial that was called the Pounds Lost trial, and they put obese people on four different macronutrient diets, but they were all calorie restricted diets. And they compared all kinds of different things. One of the things they compared was cravings. And one of the things that they showed was on all of the diets where blood sugar was tightly regulated, so that meant that carbohydrates weren't excessive, sugar, like general carbohydrates and general food cravings, like fast food cravings, salty food cravings, all diminished, and cravings for fruits and vegetables increased. And I think that, yeah, I think that says a lot about returning to, you know, because what was happening with these restricted diets, people were returning to more nutrient-dense foods. It automatically eliminated, you know, fast food in every single situation because they were all designed to be weight loss diets. And that when you sort of return to nutrient-dense foods, that becomes what tastes good, what's palatable, and what your body actually craves. I think it's a really interesting...
Well, I think it's a good point because it's like... Sorry, I'm from New Jersey. We cut everybody off driving or talking. But I don't want to forget this point because there are so many people out there. You guys have probably seen them too. I don't know if maybe you've had like a gossip dish session because I know you guys do a segment like that. But there are a lot of people out there who are like, if you're craving sugar, you should eat sugar. And I'm like, you know what? That's just idiotic to tell people because craving sugar, as you know, from an evolutionary standpoint and from like what you were just talking about in this study, if you talk about craving carbohydrate, craving real natural food, that is absolutely your body telling you something that it needs. But when your body is telling you it needs sugar, and I'm saying that again in like finger quotes, you probably want carbohydrate. But the truth of the matter is that doesn't mean you go eat a Snickers bar. Like what you should be eating perhaps are carbohydrates, but in the form that your body really wants like them in.
A sweet potato.
And most of the time I'd be willing to bet, I don't know that I wrote about this, but most of the time I'd be willing to bet people are just totally depleted of vitamin C and magnesium. And like they just need these nutrients so badly. So their body wants carbohydrate because we're getting tons of vitamin C from a lot of carbohydrate foods, unless you're eating adrenal glands. It's mostly where we're getting it from, carbohydrate foods. And so, yeah, craving is a real sign from your body that you want something and need something. But I will never tell somebody that craving sugar means go eat some white sugar. Like that makes me bonkers when people go out and they're like, just eat a pint of ice cream. I'm like, all right, listen, if it's grass-fed ice cream and you know, you might actually get some good nutrition from that. But the reality is you need to fuel your body with those real foods. I think it's so interesting that when given the chance to get rid of the junky stuff and people started craving fruits and vegetables, I mean, I think that's awesome. And that's exactly what should happen. Maybe, you know, and maybe people use the word crave differently too, right? I don't know.
Yeah, there is
having a taste for it versus like, I need.
Right. And there is like when you look at scientific studies that look at food cravings, I mean, they have a really specific definition of craving, a really specific definition of addiction, you know, and craving really is, you know, such an intense urge to eat something that you're experiencing anxiety and compulsion and obsession. And I personally can totally relate to that feeling because, you know, as a person with a history of obesity and a history of binge eating disorder, you know, I have experienced some very, very intense food cravings. And what's really fascinating, Diane, about what you were saying about the dopamine is that there really is a very strong link between food cravings and mood. And there's this whole area of research that has looked at not necessarily the mechanisms, the biochemistry of exactly what's going on, but the links between food and mood. And they know that people who have these really intense food cravings, when they eat the food they're craving, they have an improvement in their mood. So they'll have the anxiety go away, they'll feel happier. And it comes right down to the very dysfunctional dopamine response and tapping into that food reward system. But they also believe that serotonin is involved. And what's really interesting about that is that dopamine is linked to leptin and serotonin is linked to insulin. We actually talked about the link between serotonin and insulin on last week's podcast. But what happens is when you have dysregulated blood sugars, which is so common in people who are eating really high carbohydrate diets, that you end up like breaking your dopamine and serotonin systems. So it actually feeds cravings even more. And one of the most interesting studies that I came across while I was trying to wrap my head around like the incredibly complex system that governs food cravings, because it's related to micronutrient deficiencies, it's related to hormones, and it's also related to neurotransmitters. And then, of course, those, you know, three things are all affecting the other. So what your hormones are doing affects your neurotransmitters, what your neurotransmitters are doing affects your hormones. Micronutrient deficiencies are involved in both. But I came across this incredibly recent study. It was just published a couple months ago in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that actually used functional magnetic resonance imaging to measure the brain activity in volunteers. And they gave them isochloric meals that were very, very carefully crafted to be the same textures, the same flavors, the same weight. But one was a high glycemic index meal and one was a low glycemic index meal. And they actually saw that the high glycemic index meal
increased brain activity in areas of the brain that are known to be associated with a reward, like all reward behavior, not just food reward, but you know, that there's pretty classic pathways that's part of learning is this reward behavior, known to be associated with cravings, and also known to be associated with eating behavior at subsequent meals. So they were actually able to measure that a high glycemic index meal was going to affect areas in the brain that were going to determine your decision making at the next meal, which to me is just like, I mean, there's, it opens up so many more questions, and there's clearly so much more research that can be done with these techniques and sort of going down this line. And this is very, very new. I think it was only done in a dozen patients or something like that. So, you know, there's you always have to take these really preliminary studies with a big grain of salt. But I think it is so interesting to really tie, the sugar content, or it's not just the sugar content, it's how refined those sugars are and how quickly they increase your blood sugar. So you're also, you know, all involved in here is things like insulin and leptin and ghrelin and other hunger hormones. But how that actually affects your brain and influences decisions, I think is really cool.
That's really interesting, because I think like kind of the next level of that is also one of the reasons probably why it takes time to sort of unwire that wiring, because, you know, just from the basic level of my understanding of the way like neuroplasticity works and just the way that we continue to make choices and decisions out of habit that are sort of like, I don't know if this is even going to be the right terminology, but sort of like plasticized thought patterns that we have. Just like, you know, you drive somewhere and you don't think about the directions to your grocery store. You don't have to pay attention to it because you just kind of are on autopilot. I'm curious how much those same like reward centers and all of that become sort of plasticized to where people, you know, breaking out of that habit, you know, that's part of the reason why it doesn't happen in one day. You need to reprogram your entire brain chemistry between, you know, the actual neurotransmitter release of that dopamine, and then probably what's happening with your hormones, and the whole thing is like a big concert. You know, you can't just change the violinist and expect everything else to go just fine. Like everything kind of has to change at the same time, or you just have to kind of give it that time to get used to whatever that other thing was. And I don't know, I think that's also the reason why, you know, we know the more we learn, the more we know how complicated all this stuff is. And it's not as simple as just, you know, a low carb diet fixes everything, right? But we know that getting rid of junk in the diet goes a really long way. And primarily what people are eating in the form of junk is either carbohydrate or bad fats and oils. I mean, the amount of oxidized oils that people are eating is pretty scary. And it's not generally just protein that people are kind of derailed on. So I think it's really interesting stuff. It does leave more questions probably than answers, but anyway, I'm curious.
Yeah. And I also, how nutrient sufficiency would affect the plasticity of the system. So
that would be a good question for Mira and Jason Calton, specifically Jason, perhaps.
He probably knows.
His favorite word is micronutrient, and micronutrient sufficiency is probably his favorite phrase. So I think
we totally had them on a little while ago and geeked out. I think we called it the micronutrient deficiency show, but we talked about sufficiency more than we talked about deficiency.
Yeah, it is really, it's cool. Anyway, it's really interesting. And I think the more we talk about like paleo being so different for everybody, you know, we try not to get into like too much minutia, but when you do look at like, what are we really trying to get at here? We're trying to get our bodies to this place where we're actually putting the right nutrients in. And it, you know, we've learned perhaps which foods are not the best source and which ones are better and which some people can eat and can and whatnot. But at the end of the day, I mean, that is really what we're trying to do, isn't it? Like, get those micronutrients in.
Yep.
You ready for some questions?
Me? Are they for me?
They're for both of you.
They're Stacey, you get to answer two.
Okay.
I'm ready.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Our first question is from Steph from Duncan, BC, Canada, which, Stacey, is like an hour's drive from where I grew up. So
is this what I'm like? Which part of the country is that?
British Columbia is on the west coast. It borders Washington State. Okay. So
very far away and cold.
No, it is not cold. Okay, so just back up. Canada is not a frozen wasteland. There are areas of Canada that are very mild. There are areas of Canada that have incredibly hot, humid, sticky, horrible summers. And there are many different climates within Canada, just like there are many different climates within America. There are no tropical climates. There's no Florida. But the west coast of Canada has very, very mild, rainy, gray winters, very similar weather to Seattle. We almost never see snow. And when there is snow, the entire city shuts down because it doesn't know how to handle it. So just...
Canadians are pretty much as defensive as people from New Jersey, I think.
My goodness. I'm geographically deficient.
I am too. I don't know any of that stuff.
I'm just taking my opportunity to break some common Canada myths. I take every opportunity. That's one of my missions living in the West.
Are you ready for your citizenship test? You want me to start quizzing you on the sixth president? Are we ready for that yet?
Sixth? I could probably do the first couple.
Let's read this question.
Okay. All right, from Steph. Hi, Stacey and Sarah. I love the show. It has been really helpful as I transitioned to paleo. I love my wine and gave it up for 4 weeks of elimination diet as I started to transition. I have slowly introduced wine back into my life, a glass of wine or two on a Saturday night. I am experiencing terrible hangovers. I've tried white and red, organic and sulfite-free. What is going on here? Am I doomed to never enjoy an alcoholic beverage ever again? Also, I have noticed that if I cheat even just a little bit, food-wise, by design or on purpose, which I think means the same thing, that's okay, I get a terrible food hangover the next day. Ugh, I know this will help me keep me on track with the paleo lifestyle, but man, does it ever suck. I would love your thoughts. Is this just the reality of the paleo lifestyle? When I say cheat, I really mean the tiniest little thing, like two small paleo chocolate chip cookies after dinner and a couple of extra chocolate chips. Thanks so much for all that you do, and I look forward to hearing from you.
So it was addressed to me, but Diane, I'll let you tackle it before.
No, you can go ahead.
No? Okay.
Yeah.
So I, too, have food hangovers. Well, we'll call them food hangovers from wine. I get what I call a sugar hangover now. And unfortunately, one of the side effects of the paleo lifestyle is learning what negatively affects your body. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It just takes you a little while to kind of adjust. And what I have found personally that's really great about this lifestyle is that once your body is clean, then you can test other things to figure out what you do like. So although it might be really sad for you that wine affects you negatively, because I had that happen to me last year, I had to admit that it obviously wasn't the right food for me if it made me feel not great every time I ate it. I found an alcoholic beverage that did work. So although, you know, I'm answering yes, this is an effect of the paleo lifestyle, I would say no, you're not doomed to never enjoy an alcoholic beverage again. One of the things that I learned is that I am very sensitive to grain-based alcohols, and I'm very sensitive to high sugar alcohols. So wine is a grape-based alcohol, so it's very high in sugar. There are some other alcohols that are higher in sugar that I don't consume, but gin and tequila work just great for me. So if I am going to indulge, I have learned that I can indulge in those without necessarily feeling sick the next day. So I joke on the show that gin and kombucha is my drink of choice, but that's not actually a joke. that is my drink of choice.
I have tasted Stacey's gin and kombucha, and I can attest to the fact that it it's very delicious, and that that is what Stacy drinks.
And for me personally, I think whether it's in my head or not, the kombucha has a balance for me of, you know, like a water ratio, and it's not sweetened at all, but it gives me the flavor that I'm looking for, so I'm not over-consuming sugar. That's just me personally. Everybody's going to have a drink that they like the best. I know Rob made the NorCal margarita kind of infamous. Everybody has their own thing.
And other people get drunk off of a dessert that has vanilla in it.
Those just other people are sand. Weird.
Right. Wow, it's, that's rough.
I know. Well, so what happened with me was I wasn't a big drinker before. And then when I started the autoimmune protocol, I went completely zero alcohol. And I didn't even try it for like over a year. And I'm pretty sure now that my liver just makes no alcohol dehydrogenase. And so when I do have, you know, like a dessert that might have a couple tablespoons of rum in it, or a dessert that has vanilla but wasn't like cooked, I get tipsy, and if depending on the alcohol content, I will get drunk. And so I've just decided that trying a glass of wine would be dumb.
That happened the first time I drank kombucha. Granted, that was in 2007, and I think the kombucha was what now tends to get labeled as like the black label.
Totally.
Or, you know,
yes.
It's the stronger stuff. But this was back when I had a 6-month stint at Lululemon, and like everyone was drinking kombucha. And
yeah.
I was like, what is that? I don't know. And I had a few sips and I was like, why am I drunk folding pants? What the heck is going on?
Yeah, that
I was like, you guys, what is this stuff?
I'm like, I don't know what's happening, but it's totally legal and I'm going to drink this whole bottle.
I was like, actually, I was like, I don't like this. I don't really like the taste of alcohol. So it was weird.
I have gotten drunk off regular non-gin kombucha as well.
So Diane, what do you think about this paleo chocolate chip situation here?
You know, I have to say, I've never heard of like a severe food hangover from a couple of like paleo cookies. And I mean, it sounds like there's something, I don't know. It sounds like something else is going on. Like, what is it that's doing that to her? Who made those cookies? How much sugar was in them? You know, like seriously, I mean, when I,
or soy or dairy or maybe something else.
I mean, she says paleo chocolate chip cookies. So, but the other thing that kind of was a flag for me is she said she did 4 weeks on an elimination diet. So I'm wondering like, what was she doing the elimination diet for? Maybe there's some like candida situation going on. I don't know like what could play into this, or if that elimination diet kicked off like a carbohydrate deficiency, not like a carbohydrate deficiency, but like if she went too low carb, if now her body's rebounding, like I agree with you. Like,
I have no idea. I think her question about the alcohol, am I doomed to never enjoy an alcoholic beverage again? Well, it sounds like you might enjoy it when you drink it. It's just the next day that's probably the problem. And the other thing is too, like, I know this part sounds really cliche, and I'm definitely not somebody who thinks that like everything goes downhill as you get older, because I'm stronger and faster and fitter than I, you know, was 10 years ago now, which Stacey, I'm sure you can probably say the same. Sarah, maybe you're the same.
Yeah.
But like, I do think that, I don't know if this is something that happens as we age, like that we do, maybe some of us, not everyone, loses some of that ability to metabolize the alcohol well. I don't know. I think it's interesting, but I definitely will get a hangover from like 2 ciders. And
yeah, hard cider is another one I can't do.
Previously, it really would have just been like 4, you know, 4 used to be my limit. And now it's like, okay, I think just a couple. And I definitely feel it the next day. I feel, you know, I feel pretty wrecked the next day after, you know, just maybe 2 or 3 drinks, like over hours and hours. So
you should switch to gin and kombucha. This is really the solution to everything.
I don't really like the taste of alcohol. I don't like, I've tried mixing kombucha with other things. I don't really care for it. So it's a tough one for me. I like alcoholic drinks that don't really taste like alcohol. I like the sweeter ones, and that's probably part of the downfall as well. But anyway, I don't really know specifically, but it doesn't sound like it's just,
it's
a paleo cookie leaves you feeling wrecked the next day. Like something, there's something about that. Maybe there's something else going on there.
You can get hangover-like symptoms from a food sensitivity. So that, to me, was like the...
That's more what I'm thinking. Like, maybe it's just a lot of nuts that she's eating and she wouldn't normally eat that. Maybe somebody's
chocolate.
Making...
Chocolate is actually one of the higher allergenic foods.
Maybe there's soy in the chocolate. I mean, not everybody's idea of a paleo cookie is the same.
So in her pre-question, she says she has Crohn's. She avoids nightshades. She eats nuts in moderation. She eats almonds almost daily with no adverse reactions. So, I mean, maybe that is, you know, I don't know.
I used to have no adverse reactions to almonds until like 2 months ago when I suddenly became allergic to them. So, I mean.
That's awful. I mean, as somebody who's also highly sensitive to almonds, I feel your pain.
I can't eat any nuts except the non-paleo ones now. Peanuts and cashews are really the only ones I don't react to.
Even chestnuts?
Chestnuts I didn't find I was reacting to. I'm not sure I'd want to eat them all the time and then like make that happen.
That basically happened with like the stress of getting the books done. Yeah.
Yeah, it was basically like we'd finished all the recipes for I think both books because I actually made in the Sugar Detox cookbook, as much as I don't bake, I actually made this like nutty apple crumb cake. I think that's in the cookbook. It's actually really, really good, if I do say so myself. And it's just sweetened with, you know, some cooked down apples. But that was a pretty decent amount of almond flour. But not long after that, I couldn't eat almonds or hazelnuts anymore.
I would like to point out that, as Sarah pointed out, that this happened during bookend stress thing.
And it, but it's not a digestive thing. It's like I had other nut allergies before that.
I know. I'm just talking about the interaction between cortisol and the immune system. You can actually have immune dysfunction that is purely caused by increased cortisol and increased cortisol resistance. And so that development of IgE antibodies against food proteins during a high stress period of time, it, like, is Totally real. Not fun.
But I read this book once, Practical Paleo, and it encouraged me to eat like bone broth and fermented foods and stuff, and that really helped me recover from what you're talking about.
I've been eating plenty.
You know, it's one of our favorite books. We mention it all the time.
Almost every episode, we're like, let's get Practical Paleo.
Oh, thanks, guys. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, I'm sure, Stacey, you have this experience with maybe both of your books now, and Sarah, you will at some point. You like forget what you even put in the book because it's just now it's been so long, and I'm like, oh yeah, I have this really awesome guide to digestion and one to leaky gut, wherein I state maybe 25 plus contributors to leaky gut.
I've already forgotten three quarters of my book, and it's not yet.
But no, I have a hard time remembering. That stress was like at the top of what was contributing to that. But I think also, so to the point of the question that we had too, I just think sometimes people say, well, I've always been able to eat this and now I can't. And I'm like, well, pretty much, you know, if there's a food that you're allergic to and like you guys are saying with stress, you know, there's a possibility that you may not be allergic to it at another point in time. But the reality is a lot of times it's sort of it hits like a critical mass, you know, where it's like, yeah, you could eat that before, but now you can't.
The point of an elimination diet is to be reintroducing foods during that window of time where the cells that react to those foods are high, but the cells that keep the reaction under control are low. Because the cells that keep the reaction under control die off faster than the cells that react. That's the whole point of an elimination diet, is to magnify the reactions.
Yeah. And
make it obvious.
Paleo is basically you're on an elimination diet sort of all the time, you know, unless you challenge it with your other foods.
The solution for her is just eat bacon wrapped eight rolls, right? I mean,
honestly, like you were saying, you know, something about healing my gut so that I can, I don't know, perhaps eat nuts again. Yeah, that would be nice. But sometimes I'm just like, find something else to enjoy. And I know that sounds maybe rough, but I think if you don't feel good eating something in time, you realize you don't even want that thing anymore.
That's true.
So there's other drinks to have, other little treats perhaps to enjoy.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just, it's like Diane said, it's part of the elimination diet, which, and how kind of I started off answering the question is just, that's part of what you learn of being on the paleo lifestyle or coming out of an elimination diet. Like the whole point is to help you know what your body is or isn't reacting to, because, you know, otherwise you have like a low level of inflammation 100% of the time. So now you might be seeing a reaction from eating paleo cookies or wine, whereas before, instead of seeing a reaction, you were just generally lethargic all the time, or you had allergies all the time, or whatever it is. Like, that's probably alleviated, but now you get a hangover after wine. I personally would take the latter over the former, but, you know, to each their own.
All right, so I know we're already running late, but let's do one more question, because I think this is a very frequently asked question that's probably relevant for a lot of people who are trying to figure out what their New Year's resolutions are. So this question is from Stephanie from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And she writes, "Hi, I love your podcast. I have a general question regarding liver cleanses and flushes. I value your opinions and have followed your blogs and podcasts for a while. Recently, a friend was interested in a cleanse, and I couldn't remember either of you discussing it. What are your thoughts and or experiences? Do people need a cleanse despite sticking to real food? Thanks."
I do not cleanse.
Do you want me to answer that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go for it.
I don't think people need a cleanse. I think what I mentioned much earlier in the show about giving your liver the chance it needs to just deal with detoxifying just environmental toxins and other types of stressors and insults that are coming in without you making it worse with things like sugar and alcohol. I think that's a really great approach. People who might need a legitimate liver detox protocol will be somebody who maybe has issues with heavy metal toxicity or other types of much like deeper sort of clinical issues that would need to really be determined medically. It's not something that it's like, oh, let me just do this cleanse. Let me drink green juice for 3 days and I'll cleanse my liver, or do the olive oil like gallbladder flush or whatever it may be. You know, all of these things should be working harmoniously and consistently 24/7, 365. Like, your liver is constantly detoxifying. So the way I look at it is it's sort of like, maybe this is a strange analogy, but it's sort of like, are you trying to clean your kitchen with a dirty sponge? Do you just keep sopping up wine with the sponge and then trying to clean the kitchen? Or are you actually going to like just run water through the sponge and squeeze it out and let it continue to do its job without putting more gunk into it, and let it do its job cleaning without trying to muck it up along the way? So that's kind of my approach to a cleanse or something that's called a detox, but is much more gimmicky. Whereas that's why I was saying in the beginning, like the 21-day sugar detox is not a gimmicky program. Like, you don't need potions or pills or shakes or any of that stuff to make it work, because unless you have a clinical issue where your liver actually does not work properly, which a practitioner would need to determine that for you, if you've got issues with phase 1 or phase 2 liver detox, there's different signs and symptoms of that stuff. But I think by and large, like most people out there really just need to stop insulting the liver with everything else. This is a question I asked one of the doctors that was on the low carb cruise last year. I was like, you know, one of the things that I tell people is, and I was saying this to him, I was like, I tend to tell people that if they want to allow their body to detoxify well, that alcohol anywhere in the mix is getting in the way of that. Like, literally, you put alcohol in and it's priority 1 for your liver to detoxify that. And I think as somebody who doesn't really care for the taste of alcohol, it's easy for me to say that. Like, it's not hard for me to not drink for weeks and weeks on end, maybe even months. That's not difficult for me. And that's not because I'm on a high horse about it. There are other things that are more difficult for me. But that is one thing that I think a lot of people don't they don't want to think about it that way. So like, well, I heard a glass of red wine a night is good for you. Well, it might be good for people in general, perhaps for some reasons, but is it good for you? I don't know. Is your liver, you know, do you have signs that your liver's not working well? What is it that makes you want to, you know, do something to support your liver detox? That's just kind of like the basics. The only other thing I had to say on this is that I know there are some naturopathic doctors out there who don't necessarily do the whole liver cleanse thing all the time, but might include, if they do some supplementation, might include something like milk thistle, which is just an herb that naturally supports liver detox. And that's something that I could kind of more get on board with, like drinking a tea that includes milk thistle, or just kind of doing something again to support natural detox. But I don't like the idea of doing it in a way that, you know, is sort of a calorie-free cleanse type of thing.
Well, I mean, I guess the question that I have is, when I hear about those things, I'm always wondering how people are managing their blood sugar and metabolism. Because either it's a juice fast where you're on a sugar rush the whole time from taking out the fibers from fruits and vegetable and then drinking in the juice, or it's like a no-calorie fast for an extended amount of time where I worry about someone's metabolism. Like, and what's yeah. the...
And both high sugar and zero calories are actually really strenuous on the liver.
Yeah. I mean, and Sarah, you might have more information on this, but from my recollection of, you know, liver detox biochemistry, we need protein to have that whole thing work too. Like when I think about the fact that some people will go on a juice fast, I'm like, wait, you're not actually supporting liver detox because we need some amino acids in the mix there to get that going. Am I making that up?
No, you're not making that up. I don't think I could tell you which amino acids are involved in which reactions.
Okay.
But definitely you need amino acids, you need essential fatty acids, you need a variety of vitamins and minerals, and you need some vitamins and minerals that you can't get from vegetables. Like you need B12. And unless you happen to be eating a ton of leafy greens and have really, really, really robust gut bacteria that can make that B12 for you, you can't get sufficient B12 with a vegetable, which is what those juice fasts are, like a vegetable-based
Well, and just
diet.
To clarify, even because I know enough people in my own life who do these green juice fast cleanses, you know, I don't want what Sarah just said to justify someone saying, well, I do a green juice fast, and therefore that's where my, you know, B12 is coming from, the green
vegetables. No, I'm trying to say that you need to get B12 from animal foods. I'm trying to say that you cannot get it sufficient amounts from a juice fast. Did I sound like I was
that
trying
was
to say?
That was clear to me.
Yes. Yeah. I heard unless you're doing
right.
leafy green, blah, blah, blah. And that's where I think that there are a few people.
No, no. Yeah.
Like,
no.
Okay, I'm ignoring the rest of what you said.
Right.
Eat green leafy.
please listen to the last part, which basically was, if you are feeling like you need a juice fast, chances are you have gut dysbiosis and your diet is not optimal, which means that you are not making it. There's no evidence to suggest that we can get enough B12 from a vegetarian diet. And B12 is one of the critical liver detox substrates. So along with a bunch of other B vitamins, selenium, sulfur, molybdenum, which is why you often see those things in supplements designed for supporting mm-hmm. liver detox. So my point is that the paleo diet, especially one where you're including things like bone broth, organ meat, seafood, lots of vegetables, the sort of nutrient-dense focus that Stacey and I talk about every show, Stacey? Every single show?
If one gets past me, then I have failed.
So, you know, when you focus on this nutrient-dense diet, you're actually, you know, providing your liver with everything that it needs to detoxify and do its job, which is, by the way, more than just detoxification. Liver also is one of the major controllers of metabolism, of energy storage. It makes bile, which then creates your ability to digest fats. There are all kinds of immune cells that originate from the liver. The liver is the main source of a bunch of types of proteins called complement proteins, which are part of the innate immune system. And the liver's a really, really important organ, which is why we can't live without it, with a lot of different jobs. And when you have a nutrient-dense diet, you provide your liver with everything that it needs to function optimally. And, you know, certainly, like Diane mentioned, there are some supplements that are known to help support liver detoxification pathways, and milk thistle being the best studied out of all of them. And there are situations where supplementation can be beneficial, for example, heavy metal toxicity, but also MTHFR mutations, specifically the C667T mutation, which affects the methylation cycle, which then affects a whole pile of the molecular interactions or molecular reactions that happen within the liver. And in that case, there's some good evidence that supplementing with B vitamins and making sure that you're getting lots of sulfur-rich foods, which is things like cruciferous vegetables like cabbage and kale, that is really important for supporting liver function. And so there's definitely some situations where some extra supplements can be useful. But as a person who's just trying to be healthy and looking at a cleanse, I mean, I have a tremendous focus on, you know, finding optimal health for myself. And I have never done a liver cleanse and I never intend to do one.
That cover it for you, Diane?
Yeah, I'm in agreement on that. Unless something were to come up where I was like, you know, sick and didn't know why, and actually, you know, had to go to a practitioner to work on that, and they said, "This is what I want you to do." You know, like that would really be
totally different if a doctor told me I needed to do it. But yeah,
cool,
great.
Is that a show?
Yeah, we're gonna call that a wrap. I know it's you guys power through a lot of questions on your show, but as you can see, Diane,
no, we really don't. We think we do, but we get through like, if we're lucky, it's five or more. I'm pretty sure today we may have hit four. We recorded earlier today, so please, I'm like,
I think we've only ever hit a cap on five.
Well, we started
a 2-hour-long show.
Yeah.
We sort of started having segments, even though we didn't really call them that. And it's sort of the, you know, catch up what's going on and then like farm updates. Because usually
my favorite part of the show, by the way.
Yep. Oh, my goodness. I'm always sitting here like shaking my head and just like, what is going on?
Liz needs her own sitcom. Like it has to happen.
She actually said to me the other day, she's like, we should get a reality show. I'm like, I don't know what this we is. I am really boring. Like,
I think the juxtaposition of a cutscene of her doing squats with a goat on her back to like you chillaxing in front of your Christmas tree with Scott would be like
we're
how
just
that
like,
show should go.
We're totally silly and goofy. We're just not funny. You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't know. But yeah. So that.
Yes. Well, thanks for having us. Thanks for coming on again. If people want to find Diane or more information about Diane or check out any of the books that we've mentioned, reminder, she has three. All of that is available on her website, balancebites.com. You can also listen to the Balance Bites podcast, which goes live the day before this. So if you've just listened to this show, you can listen to the one she recorded today as well, because it would have gone live yesterday. And her co-host, Liz Wolf, is who we're talking about. You can check her out at Cave Girl Eats. We want to remind you to please leave a review on iTunes if you haven't yet done so. And if you got a bunch of money for Christmas, you hit the lottery, don't forget. We love it when you shop on Amazon through any of the links on the sidebars of Sarah and I's site. It helps us keep this show sponsor-free and free of whatever kind of stuff. And we also want to, I mean, who knows,
you know,
what we'd put on
stuff.
Here.
The stuff.
I'm just saying, I like having sponsors.
I'm sure.
The bacon and coffee are a flowin'.
Yeah. I can get down with that. I haven't tried the Mocha Chameleon cold brew yet. I got to get in on that action.
It's delicious.
And then I had one more thing I wanted to say, but I totally spaced out.
Sorry, I've distracted you.
Bacon and coffee distracted me. I just started thinking about that. Like, yeah, that's good stuff.
Is this part getting edited out?
No. I mean, whatever.
This is always like, we're always recording the show. She's like, I'll cut that out. I'm like, no, you won't.
Well, even if it gets cut out, Matt usually puts bloopers at the end of the show. Like, unless we tell him, don't put this in, then we're sadly finding things. Anyway, yes, yeah, so shop the Amazon links in the sidebar. We love you for that. And sign up for the newsletters, which we'll also put a link in the show notes, because if you missed anything from Sarah and I's intro, since we talked a lot with Diane this week, I'm sure we'll be giving updates in our newsletter. The family and I went to Great Wolf Lodge this week, and I'm sure we'll have Christmas updates since it doesn't go live for a few more days. And Sarah will probably have all kinds of goodness on her Christmas holidays and the Paleo Approach imminently coming out in what will be 1 month from when the show goes live.
Oh, I should start. I should mention to people that I decided on a whim this week to start putting exclusive previews of pages from the book in my newsletters. So, you know, some of those pages will definitely be, you know, on the blog and the social media and everything, but I've decided that it'd be kind of fun to give my newsletter subscribers like extra special sneak peeks. So I'm sure Monica can put a link to my newsletter subscribe form. It's just your email address, the only thing required, in the show notes. But I've had some really great feedback from doing that yesterday once I fixed the links and they actually worked.
Can I throw in one more thing to tell people who are listening, because I forgot to mention, because we've been talking about detox and sugar detox. We will have probably the largest group ever to take on the 21-day sugar detox. I believe we're going to start on January 6th, and that keeps in line with what we do. We actually start a new group every single month on the first Monday of the month. And although a lot of people want to start January 1st, I really want people to have time to prepare and plan ahead. So we probably are going to start at January 6th, which is Monday. So if you want information on how to join and how to kind of get started and all that good stuff, just make sure you stay tuned to the blog at Balanced Bites. And we'll be putting up a blog post pretty soon on how do I get in? How do I do it?
Awesome.
Woohoo.
And I've done the program that way before. Sarah's done that program that way before. We both have 21-day sugar detox recipes on our sites. Well, at least I know I do, that are tagged that way.
And when I did it last week, I actually posted pictures of like every meal that I ate, so people go and have a look and see what an autoimmune protocol 21-day sugar detox looks like.
We'll link to all that stuff too. We'll make sure we kind of give everybody a shout out who's got info on their blogs about it. So that's great.
Cool.
Awesome.
Sweet.
Well, thanks so much, Diane. And I'm sure I'll be seeing... Oh, actually, no, I won't see you at the Nom Nom Paleo release because you won't be there till later, right?
I'm teaching that day in Fairfield.
Oh, wow. Well, I'll see you shortly, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see you at Paleo FX.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks, everyone. Have a good one.
Good night.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Use the fork, okay. Diane. Use the fork.
Had a few sips and I was like, why am I drunk folding pants?